Before the next episode of the Yalla Bud podcast, here's a little message from Folklery. Actually, it's more of a query from us. If you could just take the next few seconds to think about this question. How has your mom made you a better person? Or maybe something easier. What is something your mom did for you in the past, no matter how small, that you still remember to this day? You may have reflected on those things before, but have you ever told your mom what you feel? So imagine how she'll feel if she hears your answers to those questions in your voice. That's what we do at Folklery. And with Mother's Day coming up in May, we'd love to help you show your appreciation for your mom through questions like that and more. We'll make sure it's as meaningful as possible, and if you order by 30th April, you'll receive your Folklery by Mother's Day guaranteed. Just head to folklery.com or click on the link in the show notes and we'll take care of the rest. And now, on to the podcast. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Yalla, your thrice weekly podcast where we talk about the hottest news with sometimes very interesting people, all with a touch of what, Terrence?
Good old humor.
Good old humor, man. Yeah. Today we have a very special guest in front of us. It's a great person to talk to because, you know, we are a comedy podcast.
Yes.
We cover things related to Singapore, policy, and our lives.
Yeah.
So we would like to extend a very warm welcome to Associate Professor at Essec Business School and elected representative of Sengkang in Parliament, Jamus Lim.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome, welcome to the studio.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. Like, how's life these days? I mean, do you even have any time to you know, catch a breath?
Well, there are only that many hours in the day. What I'll say is that the big casualty of my lack of hours in the day tends to be the family. So the nature of what I do, my day job, and what I do after hours, if you will, that sounds a little bit dodgy, but what I do after hours, they tend to complement each other, but it does end up sucking up most of your what would otherwise have been free time. For most people with a full-time job, they work in the day and then they have breaks in the evening that they can spend time with the family. But usually I squeeze in, say, dinner time, and then I'm off in the constituency. So it tends to leave little time for family.
You've spoken before about you're an early riser or you do your best work in the morning and all. But does that mean your day starts really early and ends like way past what should be your bedtime?
Yeah, so it used to start a lot earlier when I was, and this is pre-baby, right? Before our daughter came into our lives, I would get up about five-ish. I don't know if that's early. I'm sure there are people
who like Tim Cook. Tim Cook is probably what, 4 a.m.
4 a.m. sounds insanely early. Yeah, but I'll get up about five, and then you know, mail especially from the U.S. would come in. So I'll end up clearing a lot of that email and so on. I have time to polish up on languages. I'll do a bit of that. And then usually at about 6, I'll head out for a workout, run, or go to the gym. And again, that was all pre-daughter.
Yeah.
And so once she came into our lives, that just became impossible. I still get up sometimes between 6, 6:30 if I'm able, but there are nights when, you know, if I end my evening work 10, I get home 10:30, 11, then it becomes hard to settle down and eventually wind down and get to bed.
Has becoming, I mean, entering politics been a bigger factor in, you know, affecting your daily schedule, or becoming a father, which one had a bigger impact?
Well, so when our daughter was like a baby, as any parent would know, that was a full-time thing, right? So we were very much, certainly at the beginning, co-parents. So we would take turns waking up in the middle of the night with feeding her. We bottle-fed our daughter mostly. Yeah. So a lot of that. And our daughter is a light sleeper. So she would get up at 4. I still have that funny story the night before we had that big debate. Our daughter decided at 4 to get up, and and she doesn't fall back asleep easily. So we was holding her at 4 in the morning and thinking about how I would possibly be alert the subsequent day, and you know,
Went pretty well.
Well, as they say, Red Bull gives you wings. No endorsement there. I'm not getting any cash from them. Yeah. But
you know, like, given you live in the world of politics, policy, and, you know, in some way educating future generations, like, how has being a father shaped your perspectives on policy?
Oh, huge. Mm. Any parent would tell you this, right? Once you become a parent, well, firstly, obviously, you never think that you can care for another human being as much as, say, your spouse or your parents, but clearly your heart makes way and expands to fill, for that person to fill it.
Yeah.
So, and of course, as a natural implication of that, you take a lot more seriously the implications of the world that you leave behind for them. And that's every level, right? Mm. So it can be in the short run in terms of what it would mean for my daughter's 4 and a half. So what it would mean for her when she goes through the education system here every step of the way. Of course, many parents become intimately educated about the pluses and the minuses of the local education system. And then as you go on, you also think about the long run, what it will mean in terms of the world we leave behind, the society that they're going to work in. What if they were blessed with it? Look, I make my living out of ideas. Mm. And if my daughter is blessed in a different way and she doesn't end up pursuing a career that leans on education or academia, then, but instead, you know, she's an arts person, a humanities person. Mm. I want her to have all those opportunities to flourish in her chosen profession that she is gifted in. So it makes you think about, well, what if my daughter were not a studious person or decided that she wants to pursue a career in music? Do we have room for that in our society? Can she thrive and also accomplish great heights, right? Look, we are one of the richest societies in the world. Mm. We should have that full complement of what's available in anywhere else. We shouldn't have Singaporeans feel that they need to leave the country so that they can pursue opportunities anymore. Yeah. I understand when we were developing country and it was like, okay, you know, inevitably the markets are bigger elsewhere and so on. Of course, the markets are bigger elsewhere. But look, if we can manage to pull Tete in here, we can also have a market that our own homegrown talent should be able to thrive. Mm-hmm. So that's my hope.
So, I just wanted to just ask, because I think that sounds really optimistic about the future, right? But was that? Do you feel that there's a very big difference between what Singapore feels like now for a young person going through the education system versus what it felt like when you were growing up in terms of the opportunities available? Like, do you feel that things have expanded and opened up? Like, is it Tete coming here or do you feel it's contrary?
So there's no doubt. I think in the past few decades, we have undeniably expanded the set of opportunities. Mm. But we have also narrowed in some ways. Mm. I think there has been more greater and greater stress on the importance of academic excellence. And we're constantly reminded of this, right? Even those that are in the middle of their careers, it used to be that you could, once you reach mid-career, you felt that, okay, you know, you're going to just see out the rest of your days. Yeah. Now it's always about upskilling. So it is expanded in terms of the possibilities of what you could potentially pursue. But at the same time, the intensity with which you need to bring your A game has increased as well. And honestly, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I want us as a society to always feel that what we need to do is understand that we live in a competitive world. But by the same token, I also want it to be possible for those among us that feel that, well, their sense of the trade-offs that they want in life is a greater leisure versus labor trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have that opportunity too. And I think we sell ourselves short when, especially if you've never lived abroad or been immersed in another society where you see that this is absolutely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Then you think that you always need to be on this hamster wheel, right? That's what the common Singaporean trope is. You're always, you feel like you're always on this treadmill and you can't stop, because if you stop, then suddenly the nation stops and then everything goes down the tubes. I don't believe that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is possible to both allow for excellence and to have the best talent in the world find their home here, and at the same time to also allow those that are not so inclined to find their little niche in our society.
So is that powered by like your economic background, the fact that, you know, you have spent time in multiple countries, or just your faith in a better tomorrow? And I say that because I mean, I'm not economically trained. I read the news. We run a podcast that talks about news. But I always find myself struggling with, like, okay, why can't we strive for something better?
Mm.
But on the other hand, can we even strive? I mean, you look around the world, like, there's so much things that are not going wrong. And you look at Singapore, you're like, maybe we kind of need to give up some things for this? I don't know. So I'm curious about, for you, you do speak with a lot of optimism, right? But what is the source of that?
Well, at two levels, right? So at one level, I wouldn't say it's because of my economic background per se, but it's just having lived in different places and seen what is possible elsewhere.
Mm.
I think that itself opens up a world of possibilities, literally and figuratively, a world of possibilities. It makes you realize that whatever you grew up with isn't the only a set of possibilities that are available. And, you know, we are often told when we're young, look, we're a small country with no natural resources, and so we need to be, there seems to be only one path. I don't believe that. I think that there are other societies that haven't been so endowed and make choices. And at some point, I think collectively as a society, we also have to come to some understanding or some common decision, if you will. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a coordinated decision, but more a collection of an aggregation of our preferences that includes saying, well, maybe something like taking care of the least in our society, rather than thinking that the least in our society must necessarily buck up and just get on with the program, even if they are not able to in many instances. I think that it's important that we open up our minds to a range of life experiences and lifestyles and life preferences in society. So I would say that at one level. And in terms of being optimistic, well, you know, look, I like to think of myself as a policy entrepreneur. I put forward policy ideas. That's what I'm selling. And any entrepreneur will tell you that you need to be optimistic. Nine out of 10 businesses fail. So if you're an entrepreneur and you're not optimistic about the prospects, then you're no business being an entrepreneur. So I like to think that I am optimistic, but optimistic for a reason, because at the same time, it's informed by evidence. And I know that any policy that I champion, that I believe in, it has backing in terms of both the empirical evidence, but also the experience of other countries that have pulled it off. So, yeah, I think it stems, that kind of optimism, I would like to say, is, if you will, an informed optimism.
So, I mean, we've spoken a little bit about the education system in Singapore and how you feel like sometimes, in some ways, it's narrowed to emphasize certain, you know, science, STEM kind of modules, right? But at the same time, Singapore is lauded around the world for, you know, being number one in mathematics and science. And there are people, you know, migrants who come here and, like, they just want their kids in our school system. That's all they want. They don't want them in the US school system. They don't want them in other school systems. Like, is there... have we already reached peak education system? And are we talking about an ideal that just doesn't exist anywhere else in the world? Is there an example of a place where you feel like we could aspire towards to create that kind of environment for our kids?
So I think we have been remarkably successful at our education at one level, but there are glaring gaps at another level, right? So I operate at in the tertiary space.
Yeah.
And there, when you talk about what we produce in terms of research, what we produce in terms, think about it. Singapore has never generated a Nobel laureate. And okay, you might say that's because we are a small country and it's unreasonable, but that's not true. There are other small countries, small nations that have generated laureates and across a range of things, right? Some have been in the hard sciences. Some have been in economics, for instance, and others have been in literature. And I think what is important to recognize is that we need to not just bring the average level. So that's what we have managed to do. We have managed to bring the average level up such that our averages are among the best in the world, if not the best. And that's what is reinforced year after year by our performance in these international comparison, education comparison exercises, PISA and so on. But then we have to ask ourselves, are we therefore generating the kind of, since we are also prepared, are we therefore generating the kind of workers of tomorrow? That part is much more unclear to me. If what we are, our education system is able to build is a competence in, say, solving mathematical problems, well, lots of programs can do that now. If it is in terms of writing credible, competent drafts of law briefs or things of that nature, AI can do that too. Even things like an ability to recognize patterns in x-rays, for instance. Radiographers will gradually get displaced. So if what we are only doing is purely climbing up the skills acquisition ladder, I fear that that ladder will run out or the bottom will be pulled away from under it. Because what we also need is to recognize that innovation and creativity and thinking outside the established parameters are not only as important, but going to become increasingly more important. And I think that, like every other population, we have it in us. And then somehow, in pursuit of the model answer, we get it beaten out of us. And once we have it beaten out of us, somehow that student loses their independent thinking. And I feel that it's a loss. It's a loss that we cannot afford to continue to have, because in the future, what will be necessary is this kind of out-of-box thinking. If it's a matter of packaging existing knowledge, even packaging it with slight tweaks, AI will do all that if it isn't already doing so. So what we need to do is something that hasn't already, because look, AI trains on a corpus of knowledge, right? So what humans can do that AI cannot is go outside of that corpus. But until we are able to consistently go outside of the box, just doing what is within the box very, very well will increasingly become less and less rewarded. So that, for me, that's why I think that the system in itself, as successful as it has been, still has glaring gaps.
So you know, like, well, what you're saying, I'm with you on that. I do feel that even, let's say, in media and arts, right? I mean, even for us, we were on that corporate, like, hamster wheel for a while. We jumped off doing podcasting and media. And yeah, it's, there are challenges, you know. But what you're saying, how do you find, I know you've spoken up in parliament, you've delivered your policies, but when you're speaking to individuals, do you also face resistance from people who, like, you know, it's not clearly broken? So why try something new? Yeah, because you can't see the impact of what you're saying. It's going to be years down the road. Right?
And I haven't just faced that from individuals that I speak to, constituents, residents. I faced it even with people in my extended family. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I personally think that we have an overemphasis on standardized tests and exams. Mm. And I'm of the view that the more flexibility that we allow people to reach the age where they may blossom, the better it is. So one thing that I've championed has been the possibility that we don't put kids in through the PSLE that early. Mm-hmm. I am a big proponent of the current system where in primary 1 and 2, we don't put them through an end of the year exam, at least until primary 3. Mm. But I have others, like I said, even those who are close, say that, well, that's a terrible idea because when you do that, then they are not prepared for the inevitability of the exam at the end of the year that has to come when they're in primary 3.
Yeah.
They're not prepared to take their first major exam. For me, again, everyone is entitled to their own opinion on this. But for me, that still goes back to a lack of imagination when it comes to the possibilities, because that still says, oh yeah, I still need to excel within the system as it is. Mm-hmm. For me, I want the system to become a lot more flexible, and I want it to become more flexible, not because I think that I want to completely tear down something that works, but because I think that I fear that if we do not start to seriously question the preparedness of our people for the workforce of the future, then we might end up thinking, and this is the social contract, right? Look, if I do well in my studies, if I'm a straight A student, then surely I must be rewarded with all that the social contract should imply. But if that social contract gets rent, if what it means is that, you know, someone who gets straight A's will get an okay job, they'll graduate with a degree and they'll be able to plug into the workforce, but they will never rise to the top. Why wouldn't they rise to the top? Because they're good operators. Mm. And we don't need operators in the future. If you want to put your finger on what is truly going to make a difference in terms of opportunities for not just business, but for the arts, humanities, for science even, it is people who can truly go past what is already available, right? Mm. And that ability to go past what's truly available in terms of what we know to be the universe of possibilities, that really requires us to free our minds from the frameworks that we are currently in. So I think that's what I'm trying to get. I know I've rambled too much on this, but
I understand what you're saying. And because I think we both were educated, at least at university overseas in the US. And while I was there, I volunteered in public schools and I saw the systems there. So, I mean, I can't say for certain that their public school system's necessarily better or worse than ours and all that. But there are a lot of pros and of the Singapore system as well that I've observed and reflected on as I've gotten older. And now I have my own son, and I also think about these things as you know, as he nears a school going age. But for you, as in terms of pedagogy or imparting knowledge to the next generation, how have you changed your teaching style or even what you teach your students to prepare them for this, you know, impending new world of that's dominated by AI?
Yeah, so one simple way that is different is that I no longer have closed book exams.
Oh,
I think it's completely archaic.
Oh, really?
Why would you have closed book exams? Is that like saying that someone who is going to drive needs to memorize the street directory? Nobody does it anymore.
My uncle still says that well, you have to do that.
Sure. So more power to him. But again,
To clarify, closed book exams means the old school style where you can't bring any material to a classroom.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think it's completely archaic.
Okay.
So all knowledge is available. Maybe one day there'll be some kind of global catastrophe where the corpus of knowledge is completely wiped out and there's no backup.
Yeah.
Then maybe those who have memorized the street directory will be in a good position. Yeah. But as well, if the world is truly wiped out, there won't be streets anymore. But what I will say is that, no, I think that if, as long as you can access knowledge, if it's something that is a click away, I don't expect you to regurgitate that. You need to internalize the ideas to some degree, because only after you internalize it can you use it. Right. Mm-hmm. So some degree of, if the way you one internalizes it is through memorization, then okay, for you, that's how you internalize a concept. But other people internalize ideas differently. Mm-hmm. Some people internalize ideas by playing around with it a lot, and it becomes a part of who they are and how they think about something, and that's how they internalize it. Mm-hmm. Some people internalize things by practicing a lot over and over again, and that's how they internalize something. So however you internalize something, that's fine. The ideas that go into whatever profession you choose. But I think that memorization for the sake of memorization, that's completely archaic. Because anyway, come on, how many of you remember stuff that you learned in secondary school? I sometimes amaze myself that I still remember that the three parts of the small intestine are the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum.
Oh, duodenum. Oh my God.
Yes. Yeah. So that's, I don't know in what universe that information would be useful for me.
Yeah.
But I will say that at some point I internalized that, right?
Mm.
But the point is still that if you're able to internalize it without the need for some rote learning and all that, that's perfect. For me, that's perfectly fine. I would much rather my students be able to manipulate the ideas. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I do, and it, for example, if I give them a problem set, I ask them, look, go get the data from real world sources, right? So download the data and then plot it out, and then try to inject your own interpretation of what you have plotted out to try to understand where, say, a given economy is. And if you need to, pull in whatever you can find. You know, if you Google something, pull that in. Of course, you can cheat. That's what ChatGPT and all these other AI tools will do for you. But you're only cheating yourself, because in the end, after you graduate, what you have to do is you have to use the tools. What I do as an educator is I don't impart knowledge per se. I impart tools that you can use to manipulate the knowledge that is around you. So as long as you have internalized the knowledge to a sufficient degree that you can then apply them as tools, a way to structure how you see the world, a way to structure how you work with others, how you interact with others, a way to structure how you come up with new ideas, that's what ultimately I think the future of knowledge is and the future of education. So yeah, I the other thing I also do is I also emphasize a lot more about soft skills, because I've come to realize, having spent at least half or more of my professional life in the private sector or the public sector, the actual workforce, that it's immensely important to have soft skills, presentation skills, and ability to empathize with people, and ability to connect and work with people, ability to resolve conflicts. All these soft skills are heavily de-emphasized in our local system. And again, this isn't a problem per se until you're actually thrown into the workforce. And the reason your manager isn't promoting you is because even though you know how everything is done, nobody likes you. And so you're never going to get to the next level, because at some point in your career, you're going to be a manager. And what do managers do? They manage humans. They don't manage knowledge. They don't manage ideas. They manage humans. And so the ability to understand how to how humans interact and the ability to get along with humans, that's huge. And I think we need to also emphasize that.
So you don't see robots taking over anytime soon, like Terminator.
Yeah. When's the last time you got a massage from a robot and enjoyed it?
Last weekend, it was pretty horrible. But you know, one of those chairs. But
exactly. Yeah.
I did. It was horrible.
Lots of people would rather pay for a human. Yeah, and it's not just, I'm being frivolous, but it's not just about massages, right?
Yeah.
It's also about conversation. Mm-hmm. You could have long chats with an AI, but I would much rather be sitting here with you, enjoying a beverage of our choice, and engaging in maybe conversation that's not necessarily as deep and sophisticated as I may have with an artificial intelligence that has a much deeper pool of knowledge. But I find much greater meaning in sitting here with another human being.
Mm-hmm.
After all, that's what we are. We're evolved apes.
Yeah.
And we are social creatures. Mm-hmm. And that social element is so important. Mm-hmm. And something that sometimes we have blinders on when we think about a traditional educational system, especially one that is based in Asian ideals.
Mm. You know, we were talking about the idea of corpus of knowledge, right? That tradition, this is basically, this body of knowledge is traditional thinking. So I know your journey into politics has been well documented. Everyone knows about the 2020 James Lim Cockles warming my heart moments, right? But I think one thing that really I think has blown everyone's minds about politics in some way, right, is your entry into politics was it's unconventional in the sense of you didn't come from, you know, years of civil service or years of volunteering in a district or something and came into it. But you came from a place of, academia was a big part of your background, obviously, working in the World Bank and understanding policy, studying policy. And like when you talk about pedagogy, you're very passionate about it. And in some ways, do you think you've sort of opened people's, young people's minds about what being a leader in a country or being a politician maybe one day in the future could be, that you could actually be like James Lim, very steeped in understanding policy, understanding economics, and then also, you know, find a second life or at least be able to bring that to the public service area? Because I think before 2020, I think most people were like, you know, if I'm not on that right track of volunteering and doing well my studies and all that, I've got no future in politics or anything like this. But I think you've blown that out the water. Do you find that there's more young people who have told you that, hey, you know, your story has inspired me to think about doing that as well?
So if I may just take a step back and let's just abstract away from that story that I think is a little bit overworn, but... And focus on what it means for us as a society if our thinking about who can do what is shaped by your performance in an examination that you take at the age of 12, is shaped by the school that you went to when you were 16 or even 18 or even 22.
Mm-hmm.
What I hope is that we can see potential as it truly exists, in terms of performance. And as long as someone can bring the goods, that, I hate the term diamond in the rough, but that diamond in the rough should be nurtured and allowed to flourish. So think about how many people we have lost, how many skills and how many talents that, not just in politics, but in any area of human endeavor, in sports, in music, in any of the professions, that just because they didn't do so well in one hurdle, that was ultimately lost to them. And as long as you keep thinking that, no, look, we travel on a trajectory. And if I set my eye on that goal in the end, and that goal is something that I honestly love and believe to the core of my being that I can accomplish, then ups and downs will bob me away. Sometimes I'm more successful in something, but I will revert back until eventually I will attain where I want to be. So that's what I hope, not just in public service and politics. I want that in every area of human endeavor in Singapore. I would like our society to have much more of that, rather than people feeling that they are their entire future is shaped by one or two events that may have gone their way or not gone their way somewhere along the way.
So you know, in some way, what you just said is a change in the way society views things, right? But going back to the some of the policies that you have championed, a lot of them are kind of like different approaches from what we Singaporeans are used to. You know, you've spoken about minimum wage, you've spoken about transparency of the reserves, you've spoken about new ways of thinking about housing and land value. But how does a society or economy kind of change? Because I think you yourself have acknowledged that it would be drastic to go from where we are now to what could be. And I think that is something that even on a personal level, when you want to leave your job to pursue something, is a huge leap. But on a personal level, you know, you affect you, your family, you're not affecting the country. So how, because I always feel like, okay, I can see what he's getting at. I like that. But how do we go from where we are to there? Is it normally a span of decades, or is it a very calculated risk that we have to take as a society?
So if you've studied social change, I think a lot of what has been revealed is that change can happen dramatically quickly. And this hasn't been our experience here in Singapore. We we tend to be very conservative, small c conservative. And I mean, that often it's revealed as the kiasu mindset. We're not as willing to take risk. But I hope that we never reach a stage where, as a society, the only time we're willing to embrace change is through crisis. As often said, right, you never waste a good crisis. So crisis is often when the rigidity of mindsets and power structures are relaxed enough that genuine change can happen. But I don't want us to feel that that's the only way that we can bring about change. I like to think that it's possible to bring about change by just incrementally changing our mindsets and embracing the possibilities. And maybe it's in the small things, but as you incrementally build up all these small things, that's a secret to any kind of exercise regime or diet or things of that nature, right? It's all the small things that you change that ultimately brings about what is observable, genuine change. And so I'll say it's the same thing. I hope that we can evolve in terms of how we approach what's possible. My role is just to put on the table what I think is possible, what the evidence has shown is possible, and to invite others to try to envision that possibility. And of course, in the end, then everyone has to inject just that little bit of risk taking into embracing that possibility. And before you know it, you have created a social movement or a policy movement, and we are in a different world, a different regime. So that's how I see it. I see it as, I'm not necessarily trying to change the world in some dramatic fashion. What I'm trying to do is to get people to realize that they themselves are agents of change, that they can be the change that they want to see.
So from the first time you started, you know, like putting ideas on the table, you know, when you entered politics, to where we are now, how has it gone based on what you maybe thought when you first entered politics versus like the expectations versus reality?
So obviously, there is a grind, right? I alluded to at the beginning, the grind of just having to go out and serve four times, five times a week, often after dinner time.
After this podcast.
And through to late in the evenings. So that grind, obviously, it wears you down. There are days where I'm tired. Unfortunately, once a year, my body will rebel and I literally just fall sick. And it's my body telling me, look, you have completely overworked and then you just need to rest for a few days. Mm-hmm. And incredibly, that has happened with systematic frequency. Every year, once a year, I fall sick for like a week and I need to recover. So there's that element in which it is just stressful and exhausting to keep on this journey. But at the same time, it's also immensely rewarding. And it's immensely rewarding in both big and small ways, right? So in big ways, it is when people seem to, as you guys suggested, be inspired to themselves want to take on the mantle of, oh, look, I'm interested in this, I see a possibility and I want to contribute my share. That's when you might bring about some kind of policy change that makes our society a better one to live in. So that's immensely rewarding at the macro level. But it's also immensely rewarding at the micro level. Every now and then, I tell the story of I'll visit a family and that family may be going through a difficult time. Mm. And I don't want to reveal details, obviously, but there was one where it was a spouse and her husband had just been incarcerated. And she was really, really scared about the possibility. They had just gotten married a few years ago and she was really, really scared about the possibility that she might lose the house because he wasn't contributing to paying for the mortgage and so on. And imagine not just losing your husband, at least temporarily, to the system, but also possibly losing your home. So it's a double whammy. Mm. And it happened on one night when it was one of the last houses we visited. We were all exhausted. And initially, when we approached and we said, you know, you have any feedback, anything we can assist with, everyone starts off being polite and say, no, everything is good, right? But you could see in her demeanor that something was bothering her. And so we pushed a little bit and we found out that she started sharing this difficulty in her story. And so we worked with the relevant agencies. We did appeals. And in the end, we were successful in extending the tenor of, because she's still relatively young, so extending the tenor of her loan and being able to reduce her monthly payment so she could stay in a home.
Yeah.
And again, that may sound like just a very minor thing, but it was huge for her. And it is little victories like this every now and then that we get that is just amazing because it makes you realize that it reminds you of why you even got into it in the first place because you were able to change someone's life in a way that they could have been in a very, very bad place, right? Mm. And you somehow were able to make it better. And so I won't pretend that I did a lot in that story. All I did was hear her out and using what I knew, I made several appeals, but that's huge. And I was in a position to help and I'm immensely grateful for that opportunity to be able to help.
I think the anecdote is very interesting because it really shows you how involved elected representative has to be in the bread and butter issues of your constituents. But at the same time, when we've heard your policy statements in Parliament, I'll admit that even for me, sometimes it's economics, it's high level economics, and I probably should have studied harder in university. You know, sat through Econs 101 class.
Open book. You can go and have
it. I need to use Wikipedia and AI to figure out something.
It's always skills future. You know.
Skills. But do you ever find that there's this sort of dichotomy in your identity as a elected representative where you have to attend to very on the ground bread and butter issues day to day, you know, people worrying about money, and then at the same time you have to deliver these policy statements that are steeped in economic theory that the person that you're helping on the ground might not even understand what you are talking about,
perhaps, but they inform each other, right? So it is when I am involved in the day to day and I see some systematic shortcoming in the existing policy. It's a gap. It's clear. Many people are facing this problem. that's when it informs me in making me realize, okay, look, so the policy as it is can be refined. Mm-hmm. It's not that we throw the policy out entirely, but clearly something about the system isn't working quite as it should. I wouldn't know that if I wasn't knocking on doors and talking to individuals that are sharing these stories with me. Mm-hmm. So I never have a time limit to when I chat with someone. If someone wants to share, as long as they are earnest and they are willing to pour their hearts out to me, I will be willing to listen. And so I listen. And I spend sometimes an inordinate amount of time. Last night during house visits, I was at someone's place for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And if you're just counting, if you're trying to count KPIs and trying to check boxes, you will say, well, look, I have only that number of hours in the day. That was not a productive use of my time. But at the same time, I learned a lot from the interaction and experience. Mm-hmm. And that informs subsequently how I will approach the, as you said, the high level issues, the national level issues. Because if I am not bolstered, if the foundations of the policies that I espouse do not reflect the genuine concerns of people on the ground, then I'm just making policy from some ivory tower. And I don't think that that's the right way to do it. You need to make policy on the basis of what is or what isn't working for the lived experience of people.
So, you know, like in your capacity now, like we've spoken about the resistance you face, you know, both on a even individual level, in your day-to-day work. But was there, what was the spark in your history that made you decide to want to enter politics and champion all this change? Because you do get people spend time abroad and they're like, you know, okay, I love Singapore, but it's not the lifestyle I want to lead. Was there a turning point in your life when you were young where you realized, you know what, I'm going to go back, I'm going to try and shape public policy, and I'm going to take on the harder role to be the devil's advocate almost?
So if I had to point to turning points, it wouldn't be some kind of revelation from up top with angels in choir coming down. Rather, it's in the failures. I've had enough failures that threw me off that track. So when I was younger, I was lucky. I did reasonably well in the PSLE and then subsequently in the O levels, that I was able to attend some decent schools. But I wasn't forged by those experiences. I mean, obviously, I love my friends that I've met. They are my lifelong friends. We would we spend probably an unhealthy amount of time, well, no longer these days for myself, but with each other. But you, so I will not give up that experience for the world, but I will say that they were not defining experiences, right? In the sense that the defining experiences is what you do after you have failed. Because after you have been knocked off this regular trajectory, you really need to ask yourself what I want to do with my life. Given that I'm no longer following this standard trajectory, what do I really want? And if I really want something, how do I get back on track to pursue what I really want? So the answer to your question is that it was through all these alternative experiences that led me to realize that this is what I truly want to do. In a sense, it's circuitous, but that roundabout way was essential, because that roundabout way was ultimately what shaped and informed the way that I now approach my career or my contributions to public service.
I mean, that's awesome to know. I mean, it ties back to what Terrence was asking about how your path into politics was different. And I know we do probably have a lot more questions, but we also know that you do have your duties as an elected representative.
I appreciate it.
So I mean, we do have one final question, which is a lot more lighthearted. It is our One Shook Thing segment. And Terrence and I can go first. This is just something to share with our listeners. So you have a few more minutes to kind of gather your thoughts. And yeah, Terrence, do you have your one short thing?
Yes, actually, it's a YouTube video by the YouTuber, Mr. Who's the Boss. And actually, he's a tech reviewer. So you would think that he's very, you know, tech reviewers are generally all like, they're all about technology and all the big tech companies, especially the consumer tech companies. He'd be very supportive of it. But he just recently uploaded a video that was that he's titled "The Internet is Starting to Break," and he's talking about how basically all the services that you're paying for now, the subscription services, Netflix, Amazon, or whatever, Disney Plus, what you're starting to see is that you're getting less and less for every dollar that you're putting in it, in the sense that they're starting, we're entering the phase where they're starting to tier your experience, you know, based on how much you are willing to pay. You know, for example, like what you know, when you used to order a private car, it used to be one price, right? Now it's like, oh, if you want the private car to be quiet, then, you know, you pay extra, or you want it to be clean, you pay extra. When back then, it was all under that one tier. So, I mean, he just looks into a little bit of pricing history of how these subscription services, this is the phase where they start to really segment the audience. And if you don't pay more, you end up with a much worse experience than what it was like just 5 years ago or something.
So the golden age of subscriptions is over.
Yeah, he's basically saying we're reaching that age where, you know, the internet is starting to break. Like,
although is that really true though? Because if you can truly target each tier of subscriber well, assuming that you have gained additional data and knowledge about what each one is willing to pay, then you can actually potentially even expand your market, right? Because you hit the highest tier subscribers, those who are willing to pay an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, you can expand the market for those people that would just be willing to pay 50 cents or something like that.
A true academic and optimist.
I forgot where I'm explaining it to a behavioral economics professor.
Because after Terrence, I was like, you know what? Screw it. Golden age of streaming is over. And here you come with all the optimism and academic knowledge.
Yeah, you find your lobang. That's the key. You know?
No, but I think that's why it's interesting. Because I think what you're talking about is like, you know, if there's certain tiers of people who are willing to pay for a premium service and they pay for it, that's great. But I mean, for me at least, I feel like a lot of the things that we used to take for granted, like that you never have to watch ads if you're watching Netflix. You know, now you got to watch ads. Apparently, you know, one of the OTT, the set-top boxes now comes with like compulsory viewing of ads.
And
I mean, local, one of our telcos. So there was a big uproar about it. You know, like, I'm paying for the service. Why do I have to pay for ads now? So I think this video it just made me realize, oh yeah, you know, we thought we were in the golden age of subscription services and streaming, but actually now it's starting to feel like, hey, we're not getting as much bang for the buck as before.
Interesting. So mine is a bit more of a happy thought, lah.
Oh, okay.
It is this clip I saw of this podcast that runs in New Zealand. It's called The Morning Shift. And a friend of mine told me about it a few months ago. I haven't listened to it much, but I've been just watching clips. And they're like people from radio who do a daily show at 6 a.m. And they have grown huge. And I saw a clip that they uploaded like a few days ago where their producers told them that they were going to have like a guest call in. And it was a surprise guest. And it turned out to be T-Pain.
T-Pain.
Okay, and he personally wanted to invite them to host the live stream of his upcoming Wisconsin Festival in June.
Okay.
Because he's big fans of them.
Oh.
And like, it's awesome because, I mean, New Zealand, these two people, they speak about New Zealand stuff, but they also talk about pop culture. And just to see them, like, all their fans were like, oh my God, watching you grow from like this to this. It was just a nice moment. And I mean, in some way, you know, like, we have dreams, you know, coming from Singapore, where media and the arts, we're not known yet, but we do have belief that, okay, we can go global. So it was just nice to see. Nice to see. Nice clip. And T-Pain is awesome.
T-Pain's great.
So those were our one stroke things. Over to you.
Oh, guys. Well, I guess I should follow on with the theme of talking about media. So I had, and since we're talking about Netflix, I'm a subscriber to Netflix. And at least in the Singapore version of Netflix, you can still get old reruns of The Big Bang Theory. And what I like about it is, well, it was a very long-running comedy series. But for me, as someone who is an academic, obviously, I identify with that kind of a lifestyle, having been an academic. although these days my life seems to be deviating further and further from the academic lifestyle. But the other thing that is really interesting about that movie is also about how people who may be deemed misfits, in quotes, can actually find their own niche at some point in their lives, right? Mm. So these eventually became successful scientists in their own ways, but they still have all these little quirks.
Yeah.
But that is just a reminder that that's the human experience, right? Mm. We are a colorful people, and people who are extremely brilliant in some ways can also say things that are extremely dumb at another level, and vice versa, right? So we must never diminish the views of someone else if they share with us that, oh, look, they have a specific experience or a specific thought.
Yeah.
We should take it seriously because, you know, I tell this to my students as well. Someone can ramble on for 90 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if in the last minute, I learned something that is a genuine insight, then that 1.5 hour lecture would have been worth attending because I've learned something genuinely different.
Yeah.
So even if I disagree with someone vehemently with a lot of what they say, I guess this is my optimism bleeding through again, but if I can just squeeze out that one ingot of valuable insight, for me, that's absolutely still okay.
Mm. That's the best description of Big Bang Theory I've ever heard. best review.
Are you watching the spin-off, the Young Sheldon?
Yes, I do. And that itself is interesting. When I was younger, I used to be exposed quite a bit to Americana.
Mm.
And that spin-off, Young Sheldon, is really about Americana, about his childhood in Texas and so on. And the cast of characters is wider. So it's not just so-called geniuses in Caltech, but rather it includes regular people who enjoy sport and football, and are, you know, he has an elder brother that's chasing girls and so on. And so what's nice about that is it's recapturing of something I think sometimes we forget, especially in an age where things are moving very quickly, or it seems like society is becoming more and more polarized, that are actually a lot of commonalities, that there's a lot of good in the world. We don't see it getting reported because it's not exciting news.
Yeah.
But, you know, lots of people get along with each other. Lots of lives are lived and lots of love goes on that just keeps going day after day. And the human condition is actually not as bad as sometimes the headlines make it out to be.
Wow.
That is awesome.
What an apt way to end on a note of optimism.
Optimism. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, James, for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Busy. We'd love to have you back at some point when you have time. And anytime. Thanks for sharing.
Oh, you have my contact, so just get in touch.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll talk to you all soon.